So we have here Dr. Ann Kohler, works, I believe, as a professor at Yeshiva University, as well as doing some teaching at Hebrew University. If you go on our website, you can find his full list of books and articles that he's written, and it's some really interesting stuff. Really quick, I'm just going to go over some classes that's coming up this week. So we're going to finish up the week with Rabbi Kelman's class, as always, A Closer Look at the Siddur. That'll be part 42 at 9:35 this week, because Rabbi Kelman is now back in Toronto, so regular times. On Sunday, we have Rabbi Menachem Liebtag's class, Sefer Yirmiyahu, and that's when politics and religion clash. That'll be part 3. And on Monday, we'll have the second part in our new series on Beis Yaakov and its historical perspectives. So that should be very interesting. Hopefully, I'll see everyone there. And that's enough for me. I'm now going to pass the floor over. I'm here to monitor the chats, and if anyone has any questions, just let me know. But that's it for me.
Thank you so much. It's good to see you, and it's good to see those of you whom I see, I guess. The rest of you, it's nice to see your names. Some of you have real names. If you do want to reveal your faces, it makes it even more engaging, but obviously I know life's complicated. I'm actually coming to you from Camp Moshava, where I was able to find the room that is quiet for now. We'll see how long that lasts. And hopefully the Wi-Fi will hold out. You know, there's all these hopes and dreams we have for life. Okay. So we are, in fact, going to be studying Parshat Maaseh this evening, no matter what parsha you're actually reading. It doesn't matter, because that's what we're doing in the shiur tonight. Anyway, we're going to spend most of our time on the story of B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. And we're going to approach this from a couple of different vantage points, including literary perspectives and also what some recent and some older archaeological finds can do to help us think through some of the issues raised by the story. The story itself, if we look at Parshat Matot, there's essentially one story in this parsha. There's only one story in this parsha. And the story is marks a striking shift in the story of the entire Torah. And I'm sure I'm going to be preaching to the converted here in saying this, but I know that when I was a kid, I never had a sense of the broader sweeping story of the Torah, because it takes so much work to study any given pasuk, and especially because schools tend to introduce mefarshim at an early age, probably earlier than they can be appreciated. I'm not criticizing the decision, but it does come at the cost of, you know, as kids, you sort of feel lucky if you understand what one pasuk means. I never have any idea how this pasuk fits into the perek, and certainly not how the perek fits into the broader sweep of the narrative. Of course, moving at a pace like that, you know, you do 10, maybe 15 prakim in a year, and then you skip to the next day for the next year anyway. So it's actually, you're not even given a chance to learn, like, where does this all fit together? What's the big story here? One of the revelations for me in understanding Tanakh later on was just reading it. I was like, oh, this is actually like a running story. Like, that's interesting. It's not just a collection of Dibro and Machils for Rashi, but there's actually a big narrative here. The story, of course, started in Breshit Perek Aleph. It took a major turning point with Lech Lecha. Began then the story of Avraham, which became the story of B'nai Yisrael. Another major turning point at the beginning of Sefer Shemot, where it turned from a family narrative to a national narrative. And then, of course, after Yetziat Mitzrayim, I don't know if there's a major turning point, but it's certainly another chapter of the story where B'nai Yisrael have been on the march. And now, again, the laws interrupt, and it takes a lot of stepping back and getting broader perspective to remember that Parshat Mishpatim, for example, is really embedded in a narrative, or even more, that Sefer Vayikra is embedded within a narrative. Bamidbar has presented us with a really interesting mixture of law and narrative in a way that it's not hard to follow the storyline, but it is actually hard to figure out why things are where they are sometimes. But still, if we're just following the narrative, up until now, the story has basically been of the march through the Midbar and the problems that Bnei Israel have encountered on the way. Our parsha is moving us forward to what we understand is going to be the last chapter, the last phase of this narrative. That's the beginning of the end of Moshe's life and intensive preparations for the imminent settlement of the new territory for Bnei Israel on the other side of the Jordan River. And the first half of the parsha is explicitly marked as being related to the final phase of life in the Midbar. Moshe is told, Nikom nikmat Bnei Israel me'eta midyanim, achar te'asef alamecha. Take revenge on behalf of Israel from the Midianites, and then you will be literally gathered to your people, which is an idiom, a really interesting biblical idiom for to die. It's interesting because it presumably tells us something about burial practices. Maybe not for Moshe, none of whose ancestors are buried anywhere near where he's about to die, but that's the thing with idioms. But the idiom comes from the fact that people are buried in family crypts. So you're literally ne'esaf el amav or ne'esaf el avotav. But of course, in our pasuk, it seems strange, right? Nikom nikmat b'nei Israel me'etam midyanim. So go avenge the revenge of Israel from the Midianites, and then you will die. Why is there a connection? So apparently this is, within Moshe's life at least, something of a mop-up operation. His job is nearly done. He has brought them nearly to the brink. We already know, and he already knows, that he's not going to go into the next big chapter of Bnei Israel's national existence. Next week, when we get to Parshat Devarim, Moshe will begin giving his final instructions. And although, all of Sefer Devarim remains before Moshe's actual death, that book really is Moshe's farewell address, his last words. And it takes a while. Although you have to wonder how long, we get some dates so you can have a sense. It's not more than a month. But if you actually read it out loud, you can do it in a few hours, maybe over the course of 2-3 days. We read it, of course, over the course of a couple of months. And the Parsha cycle in that regard, I think, misleads us in thinking about the tempo of some of the big narratives. So, Lech Lecha takes 1 week, but that's many decades. I guess I could have gone to Bereishit and Noach as well, maybe like centuries and centuries. But all of Sefer Devarim is going to take, I don't know, how many weeks do we read it over this week? Is that 10 weeks, 11 weeks? I think it's 11 parshiot, so I think this year 11 weeks. But really, we should be thinking of that as a much more compact story that takes place only, of course, over a few weeks. So those are going to be his last words before taking leave of the people whom he's so devotedly and emotionally and with so many highs and lows, passionately served for the last 40-something years, if you go back to, when he first showed up on the scene. So although the death of Moshe was told back in Perek Kaf Zayin, it's our parsha that really turns our full attention to the fact that this is really happening. Let's get ready for it. Let's think about the future. So we're going to read not only, though, of the end of that era, but also of the beginning of the subsequent era. So part of the end of Moshe's life is really thinking hard about life in Eretz Yisrael. What's it going to be like? So, of course, part of that's going to take a lot of attention in Sefer Devarim, where Moshe repeatedly talks about, for example, in Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, the place where Hashem will choose, which Lemafreya at least is Yerushalayim, but it's set up for that. It starts thinking a lot about Korbanot in one place, something we haven't heard about up until now in the Torah. And our parsha contains a story that's explicitly related to that, Perek Lamed Bet, the request put forth by the Shvatim, by the tribes of Reuven and Gad, who approach Moshe with a seemingly reasonable request. First of all, they sound innocuous when they ask it. They sound respectful and innocent about their request. And it doesn't sound like a crazy request. We've read in the last couple of parshiot, Israel has recently conquered the land of Sichon in the central Transjordan, right on the other side of the Jordan. Excellent grazing land. They have a lot of livestock. therefore, it makes sense for them to settle here. I mean, what was the point of fighting those wars if we're just going to all cross the Jordan and not make use of that land? We have the land. We can use the land. And it is also land, Asher Yikah Hashem Lefnei Adat Yisrael. It's also land which God struck down in front of the congregation of Israel. In other words, just like the rest of Eretz Israel is soon going to be, right? It's land that we conquered. So if we can live in the Galil, we can live in the Negev, we can live in the Shvelad, we can live in the Central Hill lands, like we can also live here in the Transjordan. This is all land that God has conquered for us. Seems kind of reasonable. The request takes three psukim at the beginning of Perek Lamed Bet. Doesn't seem like a crazy question. And Moshe responds shockingly harshly. Their request was three psukim. Moshe's response is 10 psukim long. And he doesn't only criticize them explicitly and directly, but also claims that their actions are comparable to those of the Meraglim, who, you remember, none of the people listening to him right now were sentient for. Maybe they were little kids. Probably they were not alive. 40 was a long time to live in ancient times. This is like the stuff of legends, right? Like the legendarily evil Meraglim who condemned us to not be in the land for the last 40 years. Moshe says, oh, you're being like the Meraglim. And for an innocent request, this seems like way out of whack, like totally unwarranted for what they did. What exactly was wrong with the request that brought such censure and critique down upon their heads? So that's our overarching question for the first part of our discussion this evening. And with that, I'm going to share my screen. And wait a second. I think the sources were also posted, and I think you have them if you want them, but I'll share them here in case that's convenient. There you go. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the images that you see here later on tonight. So I want to talk about really three approaches to the question of what they did that was so bad, or at least why it provoked Moshe so dramatically. So the first approach to this is found in a number of commentators, but what we have here is from the Ramban. The Ramban in 13th century Spain, and then the last few years he moved to Israel, but this particular passage was written and unedited. There's a fantastic material about what the Ramban changed in his commentary on the Torah after he moved to Israel. Sometimes it's geographic. He found out, for example, that Efrat's actually not near the border of Israel. That makes him change his mind on a couple of things. Sometimes he just realizes things, like he's been thinking more about interpretations, and he changes his mind, edits his commentary. This one is from his original commentary. He didn't change it at all. So he asks the question, what did they do that was so bad? And Ramban says, Hine Moshe chashad otam, ki yomru kein mipachad anshei Eretz Kanaan. She'amru bahem hamraglim lo nuchal alot el ha'am ki chazaku mimenu. He says, Ramban says, you know what Moshe is hearing here? He's not just comparing them to the Meraglim in the sense that they're bad like the Meraglim were bad. He's comparing them to the Meraglim because in Moshe's understanding, Moshe's like, wait, I know this story. I know that just as we're about to get to the land, someone says, no, I don't think we can do it. I've lived through this once before. The Meraglim were the ones who said it 40, 39 years ago. And he hears the same concerns echoing in the request of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. When they say, we want to live here on the eastern side of the Jordan, we have a lot of livestock, he thinks he reads between the lines and says, oh, I get it. You don't think we can capture that land. You're like, let's just stay here. We did it already. We can live here. And he gets very upset because it is literally, in his understanding, he's wrong about it, but it's in his understanding, this is the Meraglim Redux. Therefore, his critique is, oh, you don't trust in God, right? We've played this game before. The Meraglim came, they were wrong. I lost the battle. That time I'm not going to let it happen again. So he said, oh, you don't trust in God. Vayosef od laha anisham kehem la anicham bamidbar. L'chach anu otal, So that's why, according to the Ramban, that's why their answer is, after Moshe's long and passionate speech, B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven say, Chalil Hashem Yirah Mehem. No, we're not at all worried about them. What do they say? They say, we'll go and fight with you. Why is that an important response? The Ramban says it's an important response because that proves that they're not worried. They're not scared of the fight. They're happy to fight. They just sincerely want to live on the eastern side of the Jordan. It makes good sense for pragmatic reasons. But fighting on the western side of the Jordan, we're happy to be there. We will be on the Avor Chalutzim LaMilchama. V'nyem Mihirim V'rishonim L'chnei Am L'lachem Bo'edei Hashem K'lachmenuhim. So their answer is to assuage Moshe, to make sure, to assure him that in fact they're not scared. They don't have a failure of trust in God. They are perfectly prepared to fight on the western side of the Jordan, and they are sure that they will win that war, take that land, and Bnei Israel will be able to conquer it. They just want to live on the eastern side of the Jordan. So the Ramban's answer to the question of why is this so bad, why does Moshe react so strongly to it, is because Moshe's hearing the nightmare of the Meraglim from his previous, like literally a generation ago, right? Like he's one of the few people around who lived that, experienced it, and is carrying the scars around still. So, you know, these 25, 30-year-old B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad, who know the story of the Meraglim, but they think it's an innocent request. They're like, hey, Moshe, this makes sense. Let's live on the eastern side of the Jordan. They didn't realize that for someone who's 120 years old and who's lived through the trauma of the previous generation, they would have had to say a lot more up front to assure him that they're not actually just backing out of fear of the people on the other side of the river. So that's why Moshe explodes, and that's why B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven answer what they do, which is that they're perfectly happy to go and fight on the western side. So that's the Ramban's approach, and there's a lot to commend it, a lot of good things about what the Ramban says. I want to develop two other approaches, and then you'll see that I think there's a careful reading of later in the Perek suggests something else that Moshe is worried about that may be related to what the Ramban says, but a little bit different. But before we get to that, there is an approach that I think has a lot of brilliance to it. I'm not sure that I'm compelled by it. You'll tell me what you think at the end. But I think it has a lot of brilliant insights here. And it's an approach that was developed, I think, first by Devorah Steinmetz in a short book she wrote about Bereshit, actually. You see, it's about more than 30 years ago already, and then developed a few years later by Nadi Helfgott in an article he wrote in Tradition, where he built on Dr. Steinmetz's insight and developed a little bit further. And it starts with the simple, but I think, you know, not so simple to see observation that B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven and Chatzis Shevet Menashe, already when we hear those Shvatim in particular, our antennae should be going up and be like, ooh, wait, these have something interesting in common. So we know from our parak that what they have in common is that they have a lot of sheep. That's what they say. But structurally, in terms of the structure of B'nai Israel, they have other things in common. What do they have in common? Well, most importantly, Reuven is, of course, the actual firstborn of Yaakov and of Leah, but more importantly right now of Yaakov, who has been explicitly deprived of his firstborn rights all the way back in Bereshit Memtet. We read that he was not going to be the leader, and then, in fact, the Melucha would go to Yehuda. Menashe is another easy case, because Menashe, again, is Yosef's firstborn. Menashe and Ephraim, of course, were promoted to Shevet level by Yaakov all the way back in Bereshit again. But then Yaakov, once again, explicitly passed over the older son, Menashe, and said he's also going to be a great Am, but his younger son, Ephraim, Yigdal Mimenu. So Menashe and Reuven very clearly are firstborn sons who were passed over in favor of younger brothers who were explicitly said they were going to surpass them. And what I mean by that particularly is in political leadership. Gad is a little bit trickier because Gad is the older son of Zilpah. It's not true, as far as I know, that Asher ever surpassed Gad in any substantive way. So that doesn't work all that neatly. What can be said, what Dr. Steinmetz says, and then what Rabbi Helfgott says, is that more broadly, Gad is the firstborn son of Zilpah, who is the Shifcha of Leah, and Leah has been passed over in a lot of ways from the very beginning in favor of Rachel. Now, not in terms of political leadership, because of course that's going to be Yehuda, and in terms of the religious leadership, certainly Shevet Levi. So that's from Leah. But the fact that Rachel surpassed Leah may be enough to justify Gad being part of this category as well. Again, I think the clear cases are Reuven and Menashe. Gad is on the margins here, but the claim is that what the three have in common is that they are firstborn sons who have been explicitly demoted from their firstborn status. Okay, that's interesting. What does that do for us in terms of interpretation? Well, Dr. Steinmetz points out that they're asking to move to the east. And this is why it's in her book on Bereshit. She says, there is a theme in Bereshit of firstborn sons who have been passed over for leadership or inheritance, moving off to the east. Where do we see that? We see it actually all over the place. It starts, this is the psukim of Reuven being passed over. We already talked about it, so I'm going to skip here. It's Kayin. So it starts all the way back with Kayin. Kayin is the firstborn son to be passed over. Of course, he's not passed over randomly. He's passed over because he's also the first murderer. And then we were told, "Vayitzev Kayin milefnei Hashem, vayishev be'eretz Nod, kidmat Eden." So Kayin, after he is banished from in front of Gan Eden, which is where everyone has been living in the short time since Perek Gimel. This is in Perek Daled, so it hasn't been that long. He goes to the land of Nod, which is sort of allegedly a place name, but also means wandering. He was just told he had to be Navanad Baaretz. And that's Kidmat Eden, to the east of Eden. So in the east of Eden, that's where Kayin, who's just been banished, is going to live. So of course, when we read that, if we're reading straight, we've never read the Torah before, we read Perek Daled, like, okay. I don't know if there's any significance, any thematic significance to the east. I just note, that Kayin has moved east of Eden. Maybe I don't even know that there's a novel that took its name from that yet. But then I start to notice a pattern. Because a few prekim later, 9 prekim later, we get to the story of Avram and Lot. Avram and Lot, the more we step back and appreciate the story, we understand the details here. Avram was told to leave his father's house by himself. As it turns out, he didn't leave his father's house by himself. He went with his wife, which may or may not have been part of the plan. I sincerely don't know. And he went with Lot, which pretty clearly was not part of the plan, but he took him anyway. And then in the next parak, there's some strife, some tension between Avram and Lot. And that's because they have mikneh rav. They have a lot of livestock, right? So this is as a result of the complicated and challenging story of Avram and Sarai and Mitzrayim that we don't have to worry about right now, but they're all rich right now. And so it's very hard to live together when you're rich, right? That's why rich people build big estates far apart from each other so they don't have to ever talk to their neighbors. And they don't know, the land can't bear them anymore. So what do they do? So there's a riv. So Avram says to Lot, okay, well, there's no reason, right? What do they do for a living? They're not farmers. They're pastoral nomads. They take care of their sheep. So we don't have to stay still. We can travel around. All we have to do is find empty grazing lands. So we can actually spread apart. Let there not be, al nati miriva beni uvenecha, ven ra'ay uven ro'echa, v'nashim anachim anachim. The whole land is here, right? You can't see my hand. Right? So Avram is very deliberate in saying where Lot can go and then where he will go. Yamin and small, of course, are obviously the words for right and left, but they also, by extension, are direction words, right? I see some of you mouthing or nodding along. So you know this from some of the names even. So Teman, which comes from Yamin, like Yemen, is in the south. That's how it got its name. So it's possible that Benyamin is the southernmost Shevet in Israel, in the northern kingdom. And Smol means north. Now, why do Yamin and Smol mean north? What does that presuppose? What does that assume? Why does Yamin mean south and Smol mean north? What does that assume about directions?
That you orient by the sun in the east.
Right. Well, you orient to the east, right, exactly. So the sun, of course, is there only in the morning. But yes, exactly. That your prototypical or stereotypical orientation, of course, orient's a great word for this, because the orient means the east. So exactly right. There's a long story there that I don't have time to tell you there, but you can use the Oxford English Dictionary like I did to learn about it. And exactly, that your sort of prototypical orientation is to the east, and which of course is embedded in the language also, right? Because Kenma, which we just saw in the Pasuk of Kayin, means east, but also means forward. So Kedem and Achor is east and west, and then by extension, Yamin and Smol means south and north. Of course, it doesn't mean that you're always facing east, it just means that that's embedded in your mental view of the world. We also have a mental view of the world. Ours is just not, it's rotated 90 degrees. We think of north as up, right? If I give you a map upside down, it's totally, to use Debbie's word, disoriented. And this has been done, like, first of all, in pre-modern times. It was not taken for granted that north was up. So you go online and look for medieval Arabic maps, for example. Many of them have south at the top. And just trying to figure out, like, which land mass is which takes a lot of mental energy, because we're so used to looking at the map with one particular way. But it's also, you know, in modern times, it's also been done for political reasons. You can find online also. In the 70s, there was a map made by an Australian map maker with south up, because, of course, you know, it does bias us to think of the north as up and the south as down. And he was trying to draw attention to the fact that this is entirely random. There's no right answer to which side is our primary orientation. So, but to get back to Hebrew, it's absolutely true that the mental construct is that you're facing east, and therefore Yamin is south, Smol is north. That's what Avram's offering Lot. You go either south or north, I'll go the other one. What he doesn't offer him is to get off of the central highlands, the hills that run the spine of Canaan, of Israel. And he's like, okay, look, we're here in the middle now. You want to go north? You want to go towards Shechem? I'll go south. I'll go towards Beersheba. You want to switch that around? Fine with me also. But of course, what does Lot do? You can even imagine them like standing on a hill. Avram's like, you go right or left? And Lot's like, wait, what about right ahead? It's beautiful out there, right? Of course. So it's beautiful. It's lush. It's not, you know, we're told explicitly, like, don't think of the Dead Sea as you know it now. It's not like the Dead Sea. It was the lush Jordan River Valley back in those days, which, you know, is still true to the northern part, but even to the south, it was a fertile river valley. So Lot says, oh, I'm going to go towards the east. I have a lot of mekneh. I go towards the east. What's the end of the story? Lot is no longer Avram's heir. Right? If that was sort of Avram's plan A, well, this is indicative of the fact that he's just lost that status. He's no longer Avram's partner. He's no longer Avram's heir. Instead, there'll be, you know, sooner we're going to hear about the birth of Ishmael. That turns out not to work either, but that brings us to our next episode. So here we get, just to wrap up Lot. V'char lo lot et kokei kar ha'yarden. V'yisal lot mikedem. Mikedem, right? That kedem again. V'yipardu ish me'alach. Avram yashav beretz Kanaan. Lot yashav b'arei ha'kikar. V'yehal ad Sodom. Okay. So you move to the east. You're no longer in Eretz Kanaan. Right? Avram's in Eretz Kanaan. Lot's gone to the east. Whether or not that was technically in someone mapmaker's version of what Eretz Kanaan was is irrelevant. The point was he's written himself out of the covenantal narrative. By moving to the east, he's not in Eretz Kanaan in the sense of the promised land anymore. Now Yishmael also leaves Avram. He actually doesn't move to the east. He moves to the south. So he seems to be a bit of an exception. Dr. Steinmetz points out that this is almost an exception. It is obviously in some ways an exception. But later on, we find out that, I thought I included it. Maybe I forgot to. All right. Let's just put it in the wrong place. No. That Yishmael, we learn in Parakafe, actually has a child named Kedma. Dr. Steinmetz says, you know, that might be the echo of this. Like, he doesn't physically move to the east, but he does have a kid named Kedma, as if to tell us, like, look, he's the kid, he's the guy who goes Kedma. He's the one who has conceptually moved to the east. In other words, he has been passed over, he has been banished from the covenantal land of Eretz Kanaan. Of course, his foil, so Ishmael is the one banished, Yitzchak is the one who stays, and Yitzchak is not allowed to leave Kanaan. Right? He's told not to leave, he's stuck there. He's going to stay in Eretz Kanaan his whole life. What about his kids? Well, again, we have our two. Where does Esav go? Esav goes again after, we actually hear it later in the story, after in Perek Lamed Vav, after he has met Yaakov on the way back. And remember that Yaakov had gone to the east temporarily. For time's sake, I'm not going to dwell on that. But if we were attuned to this pattern, when we got to the story of Vayetze Yaakov Miber Sheva, Vayelech Harana, we might have been like on edge. Like, wait a second, Yaakov's going to the east? This is bad news. Esav's staying home. I know this story, and it doesn't work out well for Yaakov. But of course, Yaakov comes back. And remarkably, after that, Esav has a lot of rechush. Haya rechusham rav mishevet yachdav. Lo yachla eretz megurehem laseto tam epnei mikneyem. They had too much livestock to live together. So therefore, v'yeshev Esav bahar Seir. Esav hu adom. So he moves to the east, right, to the other side of the Jordan River. This is Perek Lamed Vav. We then get a lot of genealogies, which again, like, you know, what I said at the beginning, sometimes we lose the forest for the trees, but you need to read this and then continue. And Rashbam, who is a brilliant reader, points this out at the beginning of Perek Lamed Zion. The contrast to this is the beginning of Perek Lamed Zion. V'yeshev Yaakov be'eretz Megurei Aviv be'eretz Kanaan. In other words, don't pay attention to the genealogies in between. The beginning of Perek Lamed Vav tells us Esav moved to the east, and then, Yaakov lived in Canaan. And then we get it. Rashbam points out, V'yeshev Yaakov, Esav halach al eretz acheretz, b'nei Yaakov achiv. V'al Yaakov yashav etzal aviv beretz megurav, ki lo mishpata b'chora. The younger son who stays in the west, stays in Eretz Canaan, they're the ones who are mishpata b'chora, they're the heirs to the covenant. Now, if we have, you know, we're continuing, and before we get back to our story, let's just think for a minute about the Shvatim involved in the Meraglim. Who are the two good Meraglim? Oh, Kalev from Shevet Yehudah. In other words, the fourth child of Leah who surpassed the oldest brother, and Yoshua from Ephraim, the younger son of Yosef who surpassed his older brother. So, with all of this background, when Reuven and Gad and Menashe's role in Lamed Bet is complicated. I'm sort of glossing over that part right now. But when Reuven and Gad and Menashe come to Moshe and they say, we want to live on the east, Moshe's antenna go up, not because of the Meraglim in particular, but because he says, oh, I haven't lived through this story before, but I know this story. This story has been drilled into me. It's the story that we heard over and over in Sefer Bereishit. It's the story of the older brother who was passed over for the covenant and therefore moved off to the east to show to exemplify the fact that he is no longer the covenantally chosen heir. The covenantally chosen heir is in Eretz Canaan, as Rashbam said, Lo Mishpata Bechora, living the Eretz Megurei Aviv. Moshe's like, wait, no, we're not doing that again. I know that happened with Kayan. I know it happened with Lot. I know it happened with Ishmael. I know it happened with Esau. But once we got to Yaakov, we're not doing it anymore. Yes, we have the reshuffling of the Mishpat HaBechora, right? Who's going to be the Bechor? Who's going to inherit? That is alive and well, for better or worse, among the Shvatim. But we're not doing the, if you're not the Bechor, you're not part of the covenantal community anymore, which is what happened with Esav and Ishmael and backwards, right? We're not doing that, says Moshe. But that's what he hears when Reuven and Menashe and Gad say, we want to Mikne Rav, right? We have a lot of livestock, like Lot, right? Like Esav. We have too much stuff. We can't live together. We're going to live off in the east. Moshe's like, no. I see what's happening here. We're not going to allow it to happen. Right? It's not a geographic point that he's worried about. It's not like, oh, that's too far, or, you know, you're not going to make it. It's closer. My parents happen to live in Maale Adumim. It is far closer for them, in theory, to get to Amman than it is to get to Tel Aviv. In fact, my mom gets very, very upset when her cell service says, she's like, I'm not in Jordan. But, you know, it's really, really close. It's not a geographic point. Like, the Jordan River is not a major geographic obstacle. That's not the issue. The issue is that it's been a thematic and conceptual and covenantal border. If you're the older brother who has too much rechush, too much mikneh, and therefore you move off to the east, that's the sign of you being written out of the covenantal story. And the younger brother is going to inherit on the western side of the Jordan, in Eretz Canaan. And that's what makes Moshe so upset. He's, we're not repeating that. We're all going to be part of it this time. We're going to make sure that we're all part of the covenantal community. So, no, absolutely not. If that's what you're asking to do, you may not do it. Okay. So, the story. Actually, let me pause here. What time is it? Yeah, let me pause here before we go on with this. I'm just curious if anyone has any thoughts or comments or questions on what we developed up until now. Again, this is all Dr. Steinmetz and Rabbi Helfgott that I learned this all from. Happy to share with you. But I'm also, you know, comments or questions. Now is a good time on this part that we just discussed now. Oh, thank you. Someone commented. Debbie commented that B'nai Keturah went east with the presence of you. Excellent. Also in the cafe. Thank you. Right. Good. Yeah. So I don't know who iPad is, but I think that's an important point. I'm not going to answer your question directly, but I think you're putting your finger on an important point, that what the Shvatim are saying and what Moshe is hearing are two different things. Right? That's really the key point. That's what the Ramban was arguing also, that the Shvatim said, hey, we'll move to the east. And Moshe hears Meraglim. For Dr. Steinmetz and Rabbi Helfgott, the Shvatim say, we'll move to the east. Moshe hears out of the covenantal community. The point is that he's hearing much more profound resonances and echoes of earlier stories than they intended. The truth is, I can't be sure of that. What I can be sure of is that they respond, no. We didn't mean that at all, right? Of course, we'll go with you, na'avor chalutzim, like we're going to fight with you. We actually can't be sure that that was in their original thinking. There's just no way of knowing if that was in their original plan. In other words, are they clarifying or are they modifying their plan in response to Moshe's response? We have no way of knowing. It may well be that they were actually like, hey, we'll just sit here. Like, we're good. We don't need to go. Moshe reacts violently. They say, okay, na'avor chalutzim. Like, we'll go with you. Now we understand this is very important. Or maybe they really did intend that from the beginning. I don't know how we could possibly know since they don't tell us.
I have a question, a follow-up to that.
Please.
Is Moses not hearing the tribes directly in assuming something? Does this show good or bad leadership? Is this Moses on the way of decline? Because we know that the height of his leadership was begging God to spare the people, and when he had his brother and sister with him. And you can build an argument that as his sister and brother die, he's on the decline. Is this further evidence of his decline as a leader?
That is a really fascinating question. I don't think I don't think it's problematic to think about Moshe struggling in his last year of leadership. We know that he's said explicitly that he's having a hard time. He can't bear it anymore. He's going to say that again in Dvarim. So it's the fact that it's taxing and draining is explicit. Whether this is the best example of that is a good question. I wouldn't put too much, if I wanted to build the case that Moshe was having a hard time in his last year as a leader, I wouldn't put too much weight on this particular interaction. It is possible. I think it's absolutely a reasonable reading of what's going on here. But I think there is an alternative, which is just as reasonable, which is that Moshe just has a much longer and deeper memory of what's at stake and what's finally about to happen, so that what he hears is maybe mistaken, but mistaken almost in a good way. Like, he's hearing echoes of things that they didn't even realize they were tapping into, but actually maybe they should have realized they were tapping into. Like, if they had studied the stories of the Avot, according to, you know, Dr. Steinmetz and Rabbi Helfgott's analysis, for example, if they had studied the stories of the Avot, they never would have said innocently, we have Mekneh Rav, let us move to the east, without clarifying that they don't mean to write themselves out of the covenantal history. Whereas Moshe, who's carrying around the legacy of his own multiple generations of leadership and the previous history of this covenantal relationship between Bnei Israel and God, he's hearing echoes that they don't intend. If that's what's happening, I wouldn't put that in terms of a failure of leadership. There is a miscommunication here, but again, if anything, he's actually giving them more credit than they deserve, something that they didn't even realize they were tapping into. He's hearing profound resonances and echoes in what they're saying. So yeah, I think your point may stand anyway, but I'm not sure this is the best evidence for it. Dr. Hershkowitz.
Thank you, Dr. Kohler. I have documented how Moshe is punished for treating the children the way their parents treated him. The phrase "Lama heli sunami Mitzrayim," which is what the people at Ne Meriva said, these are the Ba'e Haaretz, is said one earlier time in the Torah during the first water crisis. It's the same word. And the Netziv, not mentioning this, but the Netziv says that Moshe had a teachable moment to teach the people how to speak, how to pray, and he didn't want to do that. The idea being, probably he thought that the Netziv doesn't say this, but he thought they're not up to it, and it will be something bad will happen because they're not going to follow his lead to pray. Better he should hit the rock the way it worked for their parents. The Torah subtly points out Moshe's error because this Lashon appears one final time in the Torah, later in Parashat Chukat, by the Nachash HaNechoshes episode. And there the people say on their own, we know Ki Chatanu, Hispalel Ad Hashem. So of course Moshe could have led them in prayer, but Moshe heard in their words, that like their parents, and he treated them the way he treated their parents. So I support what was said about Moshe hearing earlier episodes. And
very interesting. That's great. That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Those are great, great points. And I think the general insight is wonderful.
I'd like to defend Bnei Israel. I'd like to defend Moshe.
Okay.
Not that he needs me to defend him, but, later on, I don't remember which Parshan says this, but those people later, Reuven and Gad later on, they build a Mizbeach, and it's also misinterpreted.
We're about to turn to that, yes.
Oh, okay. Then I'll keep quiet.
Oh, okay, fine.
Take it away.
Okay. So, yeah, actually, just looking at the clock, I am going to continue now, and we'll have some time for more comments and questions at the end.
Okay.
So, I'll confess that as brilliant as I think Dr. Steinmetz and Rabbi Helfgott's analysis is, I'm not all that compelled by it as the motivation for what Moshe says, for a fairly simple, maybe almost too simple, a reason. And that's that that's not what Moshe says, right? He does have a 10 pasuk long reaction and never invokes any of these other stories or says anything about Mikne Rav or the Brit or anything of the sort. Instead, I think, you know, I said earlier that I think the Ramban was in the right general direction. What Moshe actually says is, you're subverting the morale of everyone else. Lama tin yunit leiv bnei Yisrael me'avor el ha'aretz asher natan lahem Hashem. I don't care about you. You know, if you could sort of like sneak off and live on the east, like, I don't really care. Like, you know, what's the difference? You know, we have X number of people. We have X minus Y number of people. That doesn't matter to me. The problem is that if you come to me and say, we would like to stay here. And I say, sure, you can stay here. Then why are the other 9.5 tribes going to continue knowing that they have many years of warfare in front of them? And then what possibly the result of this whole thing is, no one will go into Eretz Israel. I mean, Transjordan's a big place. Like, why do we have to cross the Jordan River at all? Now, you might ask, okay, actually, that's not a crazy idea. Why do we have to cross the Jordan River at all? And that is actually a really good question. It's a big question of why they have to live in this particular land. It's not a trivial question. I'm going to set it aside for now, but I think it's absolutely something that should be asked before we take it for granted. Like, obviously, they have to be in this land. Why would that be? But in any event, that seems to be Moshe's problem. And that's why, again, returning to some of what the Ramban said, that's why Moshe explicitly compares them to the Meraglim. That was what the Meraglim did wrong. The problem is not that they're bad spies. The problem is that they were mini'im et leiv ha'am. They dismayed the people. They discouraged the people. And of course, partly directly, partly indirectly, that led to a whole generation of Bnei Israel not entering the land of Israel. That's what Moshe is hearing. So I don't think we actually have to go back to Sefer Bereishit to hear it, even though I think it's brilliant, you know, and these echoes, maybe they are there. Maybe we're supposed to hear them. You know, maybe there's a broader narrative structure here that we're supposed to appreciate. But it doesn't seem to actually answer the question of why Moshe responds the way he does, because that's, again, not actually what he reacts to. He seems to be interested in, again, the long memory of the Meraglim, but not longer than that. He's just traumatized by that, and now terrified that we're going to be condemning Bnei Israel to yet another cycle of some minority group that comes along and says, maybe we shouldn't do it. And then the whole nation freaks out, and then God condemns them to not going to the land of Israel. And, you know, we just can't have it anymore. We've got against the land of Israel now. So he, in fact, lashes into them for the potential subversion of morale that they've just offered. That seems to be like actually the straightforward reading. Meaning, even though the question of why he reacts so violently is a good question, you know, I think just Moshe's speech already embeds within it the crux of the answer. And I think, again, what the Ramban said, that that Reuven and Gad are acting like the Meraglim, is, I think, in this broad direction. Now, I do want to, in the time remaining, I do want to go to some of the sequels here. And I want to really just touch on the first one, just for lack of time to do any more with it, and then move to the second one, which is not in Tanakh. So the first one, let me put up the slides again. The first one is the story that Debbie just drew our attention to. This is towards the end of Yoshua Kaf Bet. Since I started by, for no good reason, criticizing day school education, I'm going to continue with that theme and point out that we learned Yoshua, at least I did, learned Yoshua, I think, in fifth grade, while we were in the middle of learning Bereishit in Chumash, so they added Navi. So there's two things. One is that we didn't finish Yoshua, of course, because how can you do all of Sefer Yoshua? Second is that you can't possibly understand Yoshua until you've done Dvarim. So it's sort of meaningless to start Yoshua while you're in the middle of Bereishit. So this story, for example, if we had gotten to Kaf Bet, we never would have understood, because it obviously relies on us knowing Perek Lamed Bet in Bamidbar. Otherwise, this whole Reuven being on the eastern side of the Jordan, building a Mizbeach, and then the rest of Bnei Israel freaking out, comes out of nowhere. It has no background. Given our story, this story is quite a powerful story. So the report reached Bnei Israel, Yishmu Bnei Israel, that Bnei Reuven and Bnei Gad and Chatzis Shev and Menasheh built a Mizbeach on the eastern side of the Jordan. And Bnei Israel are really, really worried. What are they worried about? In one line, like what are they basically worried about?
Secession.
Secession, exactly. That this means religious independence. They have now an alternative religious center. And therefore, what we're seeing is a fragmenting of the people. Right now, we're still in Sefer Yehoshua. It's been less than a generation. But, you know, how long does it take? You know, we're not going all the way over there. So we've developed our own identity. You know, we have a different lifestyle. We have a different topography. We have a different dialect of Hebrew. Maybe not in the first generation, but give it two or three or four generations, certainly. And, you know, we're, I know we share a common bond going back some number of generations, but we're also independent. And the building the Mizbeach seems like an indication that that's where Reuven and Gad and Menashe are headed. So Bnei Israel are not going to allow this. So it's hard to prevent a secession. You may recall the American story. It wasn't so easy. They before going to war, send an emissary. They send Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen, who we know, you know, has a nice peaceful way of resolving issues. So they send Pinchas. He comes to Reuven and Gad and Menashe, and they say, "What are you doing? How could you do this? Limrod, Moel, right? These are harsh words that they're throwing at the Shvatim on the eastern side of the Jordan. And they say, "God forbid! El Elohim, Hashem El Elohim." Right? We're absolutely not seceding from the covenantal community. Absolutely not. It's more complicated than that. We're building a Mizbeach in order to remind us of the true religious center on the western side of the Jordan. Now, I have to say, this is a tricky thing to do, right? To build something that's going to remind you of the original without replacing the original, you know, even the best of intentions may not be able to prevent that from actually turning into a replacement. So if I were in charge, I'm not sure I would be all that comfortable with this response, but that's their response. It's not a Mizbeach for Olot and Zvachim. It's on the contrary, it's an aid. It's a witness, Beinenu Veinechem, to show
museum.
That we belong to your community.
It's right? A museum. A living museum.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this is the first sequel to the story. Again, there's actually a lot to unpack here that I'm going to gloss over in the interest of time. The one thing I do want to draw from this story that's going to set us up for the next little episode is that this secession makes it sound like, you know, it makes us think of the Civil War and, you know, nefarious intentions, and, you know, we're going to secede because we disagree with your ideology. But maybe that's not the best way of thinking about it. Maybe secession is not the best word here. It's really a very natural process. If two groups of people live without close ties, even if they're relatively close together geographically, if there is a plausible border between them and they have different lifestyles and they don't regularly come in contact with another, then fast forward some number of generations and they're going to have distinct identities. This is not rocket science. This is just like basic sociology or ethnicity. This is how societies develop. Okay? So once Reuven and Gad and Chatzim and Asher are on the other side of the Jordan, they have a different economy. They're not trading because they're pastoral. They're taking care of their livestock. They're not, as far as we can tell, visiting the other side of the Jordan regularly, even if there are individuals who come back and forth or so on. They will, you know, again, fast forward some number of generations, they will think of themselves as distinct from that group on the other side of the Jordan River. This is actually really important for thinking about some of the stories in Sefer Shoftim, where you have actual wars between the two sides of the Jordan River. It's not clear that everyone thinks of themselves as part of the same big group. Even if you ask them and they said, yeah, well, we know we come from whatever. But bottom line is, you know, it's been a number of generations and identities are fluid. And that's the important point I want to make here, that it doesn't have to be a nefarious secession. It's an entirely natural process that people will start to think of themselves as having a distinct identity. Now, this brings us to sequel number two, which is we don't get in Tanakh, but we don't get the important details in Tanakh. And this is the war, or at least part, involves the war between Bnei Israel and Mesha, Melech Moab. Now, again, there's a lot here that I'm just not going to worry about. But what you, the picture that you see here is Mesha's own stela, his own inscription. This is actually found, one of the older inscriptions that we have from the biblical world generally. It was found back in the middle of the 19th century. In the 1850s already, it was known to Clermont Ganneau, who you may know as the name of a street in Yerushalayim, but actually was an important French consul in Palestine and an archaeologist, an epigrapher, and also a German. They both found it. There's a lot of like really fascinating stories about the discovery of it that I won't be able to talk more about now. But this is Mesha. Mesha, the king, is known to us from Sefer Melachim. So we knew Mesha Melech Moab. So it was kind of astonishing when this was found, and it literally begins. You can see that we have almost the whole thing. The bottom right is missing because of a weird story, but we have almost the whole thing. Some of it is still shiny. So that looks actually like this, beautiful, like really like gorgeously legible. Some of it is not. You see that, like the veneer was actually ripped off, but still very legible there. And it literally begins, if the vowels were Hebrew, it would say, Anochi Mesha Melech Moab, and talks about where he reigned and his father who reigned before him and so on and so forth. So in the middle of the 19th century, you're like, you know, here's an inscription that talks like Mesha himself is telling us about his wars. And as we'll see in a second, he even mentions his clashes with Bnei Israel. So in Tanakh, we knew about these wars. Again, in the interest of time, I'm not going to dwell on them. The story is really a story about Elisha, which is one of the interesting things about some of the stories in Sefer Melachim. Like the political history comes in almost as a side point. Like the real point is tell us about a miracle that Elisha did. But along the way, we learn about the wars between Moab and Bnei Israel. The story has some really fascinating details in it, including the human sacrifice that Mesha performs, where he offers his firstborn on the walls of a city, and it works. He actually saves his city that way, which is sort of mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling that it would work at any level. It's mind-boggling that Tanakh would tell us that it works. It makes very little religious theological sense. But Mesha's wars, in his own words, are from Mesha's stela. So this is, so as it turns out, Moabite is virtually indistinguishable from Hebrew, both in its script and its language. So if you read Hebrew, here's the Moabite. If you read this whole inscription, which I didn't give you here, you can say that you've read almost all the Moabite that we know, because we really don't have that much else in Moabite. So it starts, Anochi Mesha ben Kmoshiat Melech Moab Hadivoni Avi Malach Moab Shloshin Shat. The first part talks about some of his buildings, and then you see that it starts the story. Omri Melech Israel vaya'anev et Moab yamin rabin. Omri was the king of Israel. He oppressed Moab for many days. Ki ye'enof kimosh ba'artso. So this is like a mirror image of Tanakh, right? Why was Israel able to oppress Moab? For obvious reasons. Kemosh, my God, was angry with Moab. Therefore, right, this is like Sefer Shoftim, but just like if you held a mirror up or like turned it upside down or something. Like, you know, Sefer Shoftim was always like, God called in the Moabites to oppress Israel because God was angry at Israel. So what do you think the Moabites are saying? The Moabites are saying exactly the opposite. When Omri oppresses Moab, Mesha says, that's because Kemosh was angry with me. So he invited in Omri to oppress Moab. The story gets interesting there, but then, as you see the last line here, Kemosh returned it in my days. So in Mesha's own days, they restored autonomy and independence. Now, here's the part that I think is really interesting. The Ish Gad, Yoshev Be'eret Atarot Me'olam. the people of God had lived in the land of Atarot forever. In fact, the king of Israel had built for the people of God the city of Atarot. Built could mean fortified, rebuilt, expanded, anything of the sort. But I fought against it and I took it. And the city was, became, belonged to Kemosh and Moab. Va probably Oshiv Misham et Arel Dodo, the Eschevo Lefne Kemosh Bakiryat. And I took the Arel, which is probably an altar of Dodo, not totally clear what that is. And I brought that, dragged it over to Kemosh and Kiryat. Va Oshiv Ba et Ish Sharon vet Ish Maharat. So he's not going to leave the city empty. So he moves other people in from Sharon and Maharat. And then Kemosh said to me, Vayomerli Kemosh, Lechechoz et Nevo, O Israel. Go see his Nevo. Nevo, yeah, that's Moshe's death place. So, Vayaloch Balaila, Vayotachamba, Vibakoa Hasharit Ad Sarayim. And again, Vachazo, Vaharog Kula, Shivat Alafin Gvarin. V'geirin, u'gvarot, v'geirot, v'rachamot. Rachamot, you remember from like Aim Sisra says, racham rachmatayim li'ishkaver, right? A slave girl, a captive girl, literally a womb, right? Which is what she's for. Like she's, so he kills a slave girl, he killed them all. Ki la'ashtor kimosh hecharim tita. I made it chirem. I mean, chayrim, right? So it's like, this is straight out of Tanakh, except for the Kemosh Hashem thing. The Akach Misham et Klei Hashem. It actually says Yud Kei Vav Kei in Mesha Stella. I wasn't sure. So, of course, the Sefer Torah written by a min, you know, is Roy Lisa Reif. I was like, I don't know. Edit it. I didn't want to write it. So, Klei Hashem eschav him lefnei Kemosh. So I took the Klei Hashem that were in Nevo. So there's like vessels of Hashem in Nevo, and he brought them in front of Kemosh. All right. Now, there's really an amazing inscription. There's lots to think about here on the level of language, on the level of religious thinking, on the literary structure. There's really lots going on. But I just want to focus on one thing here. Ish God used to live in Atarot forever, and the king of Israel rebuilt it for them. Now, is Ish God not part of Israel? And it seems like from here, the answer is not so much. Like they have an alliance. The king of Israel is allied with Ishgad, but Ishgad is distinct from Israel. He's been talking about Israel the whole time. Omri is Melech Israel. And then after talking about Omri Melech Israel, he says Ishgad has lived in Atarot forever. Forever. Right? This is not as a result of Omri coming into the other side of the Jordan. There's the Gadites. There's B'nai Gad. They live here. They've been allied with Israel until now. I killed the entire population. I, Mesha, killed the entire population. I resettled it. And now Atarot belongs to Moab. But this is what I mean by a sequel. This is how ethnicity is fluid, right? Are Ish God part of Bnei Israel? You know, we take for granted that they are, because we know that they like ought to be, that genealogically they're from the same nation. But we all know that ethnicity, identity, are not the same as genealogy. Like, you know, I am Austrian. Am I Austrian? Like, no, in what way am I Austrian? Like, I don't know. I don't even show up on time to things. Like, I'm clearly not Austrian. But, you know, genealogically, I'm Austrian. But that's not my identity. So is Ish God Israelite? So we take for granted that they are because genealogically they are. But in real life, genealogy does not make identity. We typically don't have enough data to ask these questions. Like, did Bnei Dan think of themselves as part of the same nation as Binyamin down south? Like, I don't know. So look, if there's a political affiliation, right? If Yeravam is smart enough to build two Mikdashim up in Dan and in Binyamin, why is he doing that? Because otherwise, you know, you build something in the middle and the margins are lost. No, I build my Egel HaZahav up north, I build an Egel HaZahav down south, and I've united the people. It's really important. I need to make people feel like they're part of the same people. These are the same dynamics that we have today. Like, what makes all, look, I live most of the time in Queens, New York. Now, in theory, legally speaking, I have obligations to the people in Austin, Texas, or in Seattle, Washington, that I don't have to the people in Toronto. Now, people in Toronto are a lot closer. A lot of people in Toronto are closer friends. Like, I like them. I don't know anyone in Seattle. Like, what do I, why am I responsible for people in Seattle? But, you know, there's a whole apparatus that's making me feel like, no, I'm American, right? So I have an identity. It takes a lot of work, though, to make you feel like you have this identity, because there's nothing obvious about this identity. There is no obvious way in which I and the people in Seattle share a life. So with a massive impetus of a modern state, you can forge an identity of people hundreds or thousands of miles apart. But in ancient times, you know what? If you live on the margins, the chances are you're not going to feel all that loyal to the center. You have your own economy, you have your own identity. And one of the things we learn from Mesha Stella is that Ish God, at least according to Mesha, was not the same as Israel. Like, we don't have a survey where we could ask them, who do you feel like you belong to? You know, it would be great to hear. Like, you know, how do you identify? It'd be really interesting. But at least to an outsider, at least to the king of Moab, Ish God and Israel are different ethnic groups that were allied, but were not the same. Now, all of the places in Mesha's Stella are all, you know, the places in our Parshiot as well. So Atarot, the place that he says B'nai God lived, that Melech Israel built up for them, that's modern Ataruz. Nevo, farther to the north. Mesha himself is from Divon, is a Divoni, and he actually is spending a lot of his time, if you read the inscription carefully, it's clear that he's spending a lot of his time trying to convince people in Nevo and Atarot and Divon and Aroer that they are all, quote unquote, Moabites. Like, what makes me a Moabite as opposed to a person from Nevo? So he's trying to convince them that they're all people of Moab. Now, I did say that there would be newer archaeological finds as well. It's unfortunately a lot less well preserved, but it was just published a couple of years ago. It's actually from Ataruz. So ancient Atarot, you see right here, the place where Ish God lived. And it's a mizbeach, a miktar maybe, an altar for incense that was dug up in archaeological excavation. I think it was actually uncovered in 2013, maybe. I don't recall exactly, but it was published first in 2019. A team of really excellent scholars worked on it. You see that when you look at the photo, you don't really see any writing here. So very different from Mesha's inscription. There are some better photos online if you Google something like Ataruz, altar. The excavation has a great website, and you can get some better photos where you can zoom in a little bit and see some of the writing. Even when you see the writing, it's not a royal inscription. So it's not laid out beautifully. It's scratched into the side of a stone altar. So the reading and interpretation is a lot more tentative than Mesha's inscription. There's two inscriptions on it. The second one is the one that you have on the screen in front of you. And this is not a guess. It's a decipherment of a really difficult text. So I'm certainly not going to promise that every single detail here is right, but a lot of it, again, you just look at the photos, a lot of it clearly is right. So it starts with some numbers. Numbers, like in Hebrew inscriptions, are always written hieratic. It's really interesting, actually. We don't have numerals in Tanakh ever, right? All the numbers in Tanakh are always written out as words. But in Hebrew inscriptions, we have numbers. So they have the same numbers in Moabite. So 460 min, maybe Ivrin, like Hebrews, possibly. Hard to know. And 4,000 gerin, hashin, vayitosh begadol. Again, this is a reasonable decipherment. I'm not going to promise that all of this is exactly right. And certainly the vowels, I'm just reading as if it's Hebrew. Min kir hatzadit, or hatzadet, zi savat, or savat, or something like that. Kana adama. Now, there's a lot we can get from an inscription when it's found in an archaeological excavation, even if we don't know what it means. A lot of this actually we can say intelligent things about. I'm not going to bother you with right now. But there's one really obvious thing we can say about this, even without deciphering a single word. And that's that it's clearly a Moabite altar with a Moabite inscription in the city of Atarot. According to Mesha, who lived in Atarot Me'olam? That was Ishgad, until his own day, when he, as he said, killed everyone and then repopulated it with people from Maharat and people from Sharon, who presumably he thought were loyal to him and not to Melech Yisrael. Well, this altar seems to be good evidence that that's in fact what happened. Based on the archaeology and a little bit on the script, the people who published it said it's probably about 30 or 40 years later than Mesha. And here we have the next generation, a Moabite altar with a Moabite inscription from the city of Atarot that previously had belonged to Ishgad. So this seems to be at minimum evidence for, in fact, Atarot changing hands and now being a Moabite city, which it apparently hadn't been up until now. All right, I'm really already past time. So I want to close this out. I'm actually, instead of like pontificating about the significance of this all, I'm going to just close it, let you do that. I do want to hear any thoughts or questions, but I actually can't resist one last thing that has absolutely nothing to do with anything else that we just talked about, other than that it's related to the last story in Parshat Mas'eh, which is the story of Benot Tzlofchad, of course, the sequel to Benot Tzlofchad. I just have to share with you a midrash from the Sifrei that like comes to my mind all of the time. Like you'll see why. So it's actually from the first part, from Perikav Zion. The Sifrei on the Midbar commenting on the first story of Benot Tzlofchad. And when Benot Tzlofchad, you remember the story, they come and they say, our father doesn't have any sons. Why should we, Mama Nigara, why should our family be deprived of an inheritance? So the Midrash says, I'm skipping the second paragraph. They say, this is what Benot Tzlofchad were basically saying. Lo karachame basar vadam rachame makom. The mercy, or in Aramaic, rachame means love. So I don't know. But anyway, the mercy of flesh and blood is not like the mercy of God. Rachame basar vadam rachamav al zacharim yater min hanikevot. Aba misha mar vayao lam inokein rachamav al akol. Look. We know we live in the late Bronze or early Iron Age. We know that it's a deeply patriarchal, misogynistic society. We get it. We understand that we are discriminated against at every turn. It's fine. We get it. People are people. Men wrote, men are in charge. They do what they want. But God is not misogynistic. God is not discriminatory. So I don't believe, they say, that God would really discriminate this way. Now, the amazing thing is first of all, that's amazing thing one. This claim that God is obviously not discriminatory the way mankind, I should say, is. Usually I'm careful to say humankind, but here the whole point is it's mankind. But the more amazing thing is God's answer in the Midrash. V'yomer Shem Moshe le'emor, kein benot Tzlofchad dovrot, ya'et tav'u benot Tzlofchad, shekach parashah k'tuva lefanai b'marom. They have in fact filed the lawsuit properly, litigated properly. For this is how the Torah is written in front of me up here in heaven. They're right. There is a egalitarian rule of inheritance here in my Torah up in heaven. I wish I knew more about what this Torah said, but this is the most amazing midrash, both because of the claim and because of this idea that there's some less time-bound version of the Torah that's free from the biases of 3,300 years ago that God is sitting with up in Marom, up in heaven. And he's like, oh, well, if you ask, I'll tell you what it says here. I just need to know how to ask. So we got to find out how to ask. And as I said, this has nothing to do with anything else that we talked about. This midrash just it sits in it. I came across it for totally unrelated reasons, maybe 10, 12 years ago. I was working on something about the language of the Sifrei. I came across this, I was like, what the heck? Like, this midrash is astonishing. Okay. So now I've, so now, you know, if anyone has comments or questions, not about this last part, but about the God and Reuven and Mesha, let me unshare my screen. And please, in the chat, or if you want to unmute yourselves and share your thoughts.
First, great class. Amazing. One comment. At the beginning, when Shevet Reuven and God are coming to negotiate, they're coming only by themselves. Later on, Moshe adds Menashe. It's not from the beginning. Why? Yes. Because he knew that the end will be exactly like Moshe's story. The information, he knew, he was sure about that. And that's the reason he had Menashe. And they got the north part.
Well, so I'm glad that you had an answer to your question, because I think the question's a fantastic question. And I think you're right. It's very mysterious where Menashe, you know, Chatzi Menashe pops up in the middle of the story. You know, source critics pounce on that as evidence of this story being a composite story. But I think your answer is an interesting one. I think there's different approaches there. But I especially welcome questions that have answers built into them. So that was great. And your observation is really good. I tried to allude to that in the middle by saying that there are problems here with Menashe's role that I'm not going to talk about. But that's exactly right. I mean, it really is problematic where Menashe come from in the middle. So maybe you're right. Maybe the point is that Moshe understood something that, like, Menashe actually belongs here. You know, he's seeing what's happening, and Menashe belongs in the story as well. Very nice.
Or you could say that Menashe, the way I look at it is that Moshe took half of the tribe. Menashe is very big, and he makes Menashe straddle both sides of the Yarden, as if Menashe, the older brother, displaced brother, will hold them together. He's the bridge, and he's like the guardian. Moshe says, "You go over there and stay with them and keep an eye on them." And I'm sure they stay together.
Actually, what you brought Sefer Yoshua with the story, it's not against Menashe.
Right.
The people who built the Mizbeach right after, when they went back, it's not Menashe, it's got the Reuven.
I think that actually does include Menashe, no?
No, there's no Menashe.
No, Menashe is not involved.
That's right.
Right, at the beginning.
At the beginning.
And no, but for Sefer Yeshua, when the
It says, Yeshua v'yachul b'nei Reuven v'nei Gad v'chati shev v'nashe b'nei p'nei Yisrael. V'yavo v'yivnu b'nei Reuven v'nei Gad v'chati shev v'nashe sham mizbeach.
Okay.
Menashe is mentioned like 10 times here. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
No, it's okay. Okay.
Can I add one more idea?
Yeah, please.
There's something, just as I was looking at it this time, it occurred to me, there's something eerily disconcerting about that conference there with there's God and Reuven standing there on the other side of the Yarden at Gilad. And 1,000 years ago, how long, however long it was, hundreds of years ago, it was Lavan stood there and made this covenant with Yaakov and said, neither one of us will pass over this Gaal.
Mm.
You don't cross over to me. I don't cross over to you. And now they're putting up another, looks like a Gaal of some kind. And there's something disturbing about it. Something
disturbing. That's really interesting.
Gal'ed Gil'ad?
Yeah.
That's what you did, Gal'ed Gil'ad? Wow.
In support of Ruth's first point, I think I have now a more positive understanding why in Shlach, when the Meraglim are mentioned before they become bad, it says, L'mate Yosef, L'mate Menashe. So the commentator's question, why is Menashe still Yosef and Ephraim not? So Ruth gives us a positive insight because Menashe's supposed to keep everyone together. I like that.
Oh, interesting.
I apologize. I came late. I needed the umm. It's my father's yard site tonight. Did you mention, Dr. Kohler, did you speak about Kamosh?
No.
Yes.
I mean, he came up, but...
I see. Yeah, no. Because I noticed that Kamosh is mentioned in the end of Hukat and in that dirge. And right. I wanted to Am Kamosh, so he's mentioned... So Kamosh is the idol of Moab, or is he a human being who is...
Kamosh? He's the god of Moab, that's exactly
he's
right.
The god of Moab, thank
he's
you.
God of Moab. He's actually, yeah, it's actually in... what's the name? I think Gideon actually says something, right? Like, Kamosh gave you this land, and God gave us... Doesn't he...
It's by Midbar, Perek Chavalev.
Right, but also...
But it's also in by Gideon.
Yeah, I think Gideon actually invokes him. I don't remember exactly what he says, but it is, again, like a strangely pluralistic or polytheistic pasuk. He says something like, you know, you have your land that Kamosh gave you, and... I don't remember that. And we have our land that Hashem gave us, something like that.
In support of your point about ethnicity and citizenship not being equivalent, again, I've documented from the Midrashim that the royal house of Moab is actually genetically Midianite. Because the royal house, the house of Balak, because Balak is also Tsur. As the Midrashim teach us, and the whole text in Parshat Balak that we recently read shows how Moab wanted to become a protectorate of Midian. After the superpower in that area, Sichon, was defeated by the Israelites, so they turned to their ancient enemy. Moab, come, you protect us, you send us a king. That's really what's going on. So you see that, I mean, is anyone more more British than Queen Elizabeth? She's a German. Queen Elizabeth is a German.
In a sense.
Right. We're Germans, but that's so ethnicity and citizenship, nationality.
Right.
And the Moabites of all people would have realized this, since their own royal house were genetically Midianites.
That's really interesting. Look, I'm not going to elaborate it on it here, but I think you're absolutely right in general. And it's a major issue when we look at the world today, and therefore we have to realize it's a major issue in history also, that identity is fluid. Right? People can become part of a people. It's not that hard to do. Right? You speak the same language, you wind up with, you know, something like the religion, and then 2-3 generations later, you're indistinguishable. Like who's going back? So of course, halacha complicates this. You know, we have a real, blood purity streak in halacha. Like they, you know, you actually have to be descended from or converted in legalistically. But in normal life, that's not how identity works. Right? We all know this. You know this from individuals, as you said, Nissan, or you know it from whole peoples. Like tribes can be part of one nation in one century, and then be part of a different nation in the next century. You redraw the borders, and suddenly Alsace is in France and not in Germany. And, you know, if that happens and that lasts for a few generations, they'll be speaking the same language. Like whoever knew that they were in a different country. Like ethnicity and identity really are fluid concept. Modern scholarship is very attuned to this. And again, both in the modern context and also looking backwards. It's actually one of the ways in which I think just thinking about real life, you know, you don't need any data for this. You realize that Tanakh is oversimplifying. It just doesn't work this way. There's no way that there's one guy who has 12 kids who make 12 tribes and all of them remain part of the same nation forever. It doesn't mean that there was no Bnei Israel, but it just, that's not the way identity actually works in real life. Like those margins are going to be fuzzy. They're going to be people who used to be part of Bnei Israel, who are no longer part of Bnei Israel. Like what happened to the 10 tribes? You know, not Jewish anymore. And vice versa. Right? What does Ruth do? Ruth shows up. She shows us what happens. You walk in, you say, Amecha mi Elohayach Elohai. That's it. You're done. Like, you know, you're now the ancestor of David HaMelech, like, which I think goes to Nissan's point as well, right? So, you know, what's David's ethnicity? Well, she said, Amecha mi Elohayach Elohai. So, like, what else is there? Like, that's what it means to become part of a people. But it's not about genealogy. It's never about genealogy. If anything, it's about perceived genealogy. You know, people think that they're part of a people. That's really powerful. But whether you're actually descended from a people or not, it's like irrelevant to identity. It has almost nothing to do with how people identify. So this is, you know, fundamental in modern studies, but it's a really powerful question to turn back towards Tanakh and just ask, oh, so I wonder what was going on around the margins. And I wonder if that does help us understand some of the stories and some of the tensions where, you know, there seems to be people who are or are not, they're loyal, they're not loyal, people are not showing up to fight, they are showing up to fight. Well, like, who says that they think that they're all part of the same nation? You know, we take it for granted that Reuven and Yehuda and Dan all have something in common. But I don't know, you know, you freeze the clock at any given point and you survey people, not at all clear that they're going to identify as part of the same nation. So there's reality of identity there that gets in the way of this neat picture, but Tanakh trades in the language of neat pictures. And that's something that, you know, if we want to think about the realities behind it, it's of course messier than that. I think that's a major question to ask at every turn.
Aaron, can I ask you one more question?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So you personally, who do you believe? Do you believe the Transjordanians who say we just want to keep in touch with you? We're putting up this big Chabad menorah so that you won't forget us, that you will remember us and you'll think about us. Do you believe them, or do you believe the libel perpetrated by Pinchas et al, that, you know, your lies are terrible?
That's a great question. I tend to be pretty credulous and, you know, like not so cynical about people. So I take them at their word. But what I was trying to allude to when we talked about that briefly is that even if they're being sincere about it, it's not going to work. Like, it's, you might think this is a really good idea, but actually what it's going to do is replace like the center. I mean, it's obvious, right? Like, you don't have to be a sociologist to realize that you might mean that. But what are your kids going to understand? What are their grandkids going to understand? Like, of course, it's not going to last this way. So, you know, things that seem like really good ideas in the short run may turn out to really serve counter purposes in the longer run. This is actually really just conceptually parallel to that example is actually, and more relevant to our own lives, all of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's takanot, zecher l'churban. Right. So they used to have lulavim in the Mikdash all 7 days in the Mikdash 7 days, not in Lulim, right? Zeich l'churban, we do it 7 days. Now, how many of us think of the Mikdash when we do it? We don't. It's replaced the Mikdash, right? What it actually has meant is that we don't need the Mikdash anymore. We have lulav 7 days. Now, did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai know that? Or was he sincerely thinking like this is going to be a Zeich l'mikdash that just doesn't work in the long run? I don't know, but I think it's almost exactly the same idea. Like, you know, it seems like in the short run, like this is going to be a mnemonic for us to remember something more important. It's obvious that fast forward 100 years and it will lose its mnemonic power and instead be a replacement. So I take them at their word. I just think it's poorly thought out.
Right. It's like smashing the glass at the end of the
right. Exactly.
It's like people say Mazel Tov instead of crying.
Right, exactly.
I'm very surprised that Pinchas, the Kanai, accepted what the Shvatim said, because he should have known better than that it's not going to work.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I alluded to it. I think it's really a very interesting choice, and I wonder whether that's, I mean, he's old at this point, obviously, but still, is there some message in the choice of emissary there?
Yes. Moment. That's why he was the one sent. It was a China moment. And that's why it would be accepted by the majority on living on the East Bank, on the West Bank.
What was the first thing you said? China moment?
It was a Nixon to China moment. Only he could do it, like Begin making peace.
Right. Yeah, maybe that's right.
They were playing with fire. In other words, the more extreme symbol that they chose showed how fraught the moment was. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, it wasn't going to work. They realized that it was tenuous. Therefore they strove for something dramatic, But at the same time, that was, you know, it could backfire easily. They were playing with fire, literally or figuratively.
Very interesting. All right.
You can compare and contrast this ethnicity with what was going on in the Peloponnese with the Greeks. You had the everything was a city-state, and they had to be forced, you know, by Alexander to become one nation, or by external threat, which is a parallel to the prophets. It's only when there's an external threat do they band together. But you had the Athenian League, you had the Spartan League, and every city was, we didn't think of of big states like we do today. And from a Tanakh point of view, it's only because they were external threats that we think of Babylonia or Assyria as homogeneous, as opposed to made up of also, and the truth is Babylon didn't last long. But the parallel is to the Greeks.
That is a wonderful point. You're right. Greece actually gives us a lot of good data for it, because we actually have writings that are not only sort of from the, 1,000 miles up, like we have in Tanakh. So we have, but look, you got the same dilemmas and tensions in Homer already. Like the Greeks, quote unquote, the Achaeans are fighting against the people of Troy, of Ilios. But what language do people of Troy speak? They speak to each other fine. They seem to speak another dialect of Greek. And people of Greece to have nothing in common. As you said, they have to be mustered together. So they're, the lines are very fluid as to who's in and who's out. And it could change from battle to battle. It could change from century to century. So yes, I think you're absolutely right. More broadly, I would just say that you're absolutely right that the same dynamics are not unique to Israel. This is built into what it means to be a human being. We have identities, but our identities are fluid and they depend on a lot of different factors. And that's why this is so interesting for Tanakh, but it's not unique to biblical Israel. All right, I think we have to stop, even though I'm learning
Thank
more.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much for staying.
Thank you for staying for a little
longer. Pleasure.
And for joining in. I'm going to go ahead and end the meeting now. Thank you so much, Dr. Kohler. And thanks everyone else. And hopefully see everyone at 9:45 a.m. tomorrow for Rabbi Kalman's class. And bless you all, everyone.